Thank you. Such an everyday word to attempt to carry the immense gratitude I feel tonight. Gratitude to the committee who have chosen to add my name to the distinguished list that honors the memory of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Gratitude to my publishers and to my editor, Walter Lorraine, to my encouraging husband and family, and to the many friends here tonight, those with whom I have shared Newbery dinners in the past, and those whom I meet now for the first time. And thank you above all to one special person, my first editor and my friend, Mary Silver Cosgrave, who is here to share with me this honor. For quite literally, it was Mary who set me on the path that has led to this moment. So many people ask, how did you get started? In the past few weeks, Mary and I have put our heads together to give you the true story. 35 years ago, I happened upon a somewhat forgotten story from the history of New England. It was written in 1807 by Susanna Johnson, who recalled in vivid detail the terrifying moment in 1754 when she and her husband, their three children, and a teenage sister were dragged from their beds in a surprise Indian attack and forced to march, scantily clad, through the wilderness toward Canada. A few days on the march, Susanna gave birth to her fourth child, whom she named Elizabeth Captive. Susanna was indeed a gallant woman, but it was the young sister, Miriam Willard, who is given scant mention in the narrative, who sprang to life in my imagination. A girl torn from a life that had seemed so full of promise, and faced suddenly with who knew what terrible fate. Day by day, Miriam's story began to grow in my mind, demanding to be written. It would be a long story, I soon realized, even a book. A new venture for me, and a precarious investment of time, which I seemed never to have enough of. Nevertheless, with a pad of yellow paper and a pencil, I sat at the dining room table and began. Very shortly, seeing that this book was going to require a vast amount of study, I began to have doubts. I had read that it was possible to send the first pages of a novel to a publisher for consideration. Boldly, I chose a name from my daughter's bookshelf and sent off three chapters. Months went by before the brown envelope returned. I tried again. When I found it on my doorstep the second time, I had almost forgotten it. Not another word had been added to my yellow pages. With a faint hope, I sent it off once more, this time to Houghton Mifflin, where by sheer luck it fell into the hands of Mary Cosgrave. I learned later that she did something which, even in my ignorance of the publishing world, I recognized as extraordinary. She took the time to unearth in the New York Public Library the rare volume that was Susanna Johnson's narrative. Her note to me contained one momentous line. I would like to see the rest of this story. I am not saying that without that encouraging word, I would have given up writing. That was an unquestioned part of my life. But my ventures would likely have gone in other directions. And I am very sure that no field I could have chosen would have brought me so much enjoyment, so many friends, and so much all-round serendipity as that of writing for young people. For all that, thank you, Mary. One small item of that serendipity. In her later years, Susanna Johnson ordered to be erected in Reading, Vermont, a small stone marking the spot where the baby Captive had been born. In 1976, the town of Reading, as its share in the bicentennial celebration, chose to prop up that stone and to surround it by a small park. In the town hall, they held a rededication dinner, to which the many descendants of Susanna Johnson were invited, and to which I was generously invited as well. There were many descendants from many states, some meeting for the first time, and I especially treasure a photograph of a six-year-old Susanna, a sixth-generation descendant, standing beside the stone her ancestor had erected. Serendipity also, perhaps, though a doubtful blessing as many of you know, is the mail that comes from young readers. For the most part, these letters are class projects, and even when they come in bundles of flattery, are not likely to turn any writer's head. But there is much to be learned from them, and they are often challenging, prompting me to do some unwanted self-analysis. Indians, for example. "Are you part Indian?" children ask, after reading The Sign of the Beaver. "Do you have any Indian friends?" I wish I could answer that I do. But the state of Connecticut, where I live, long ago did a very thorough job of obliterating the Native Americans. So why, I ask myself, do I feel such a strong identification with them? Why is it that, 3 times out of 5, the moment I begin to think of a story, Indians seem to appear? Perhaps in some former incarnation, I was sister to Pocahontas. I am forced to examine my roots. What in my childhood has caused me to be, incurably, an Indian at heart? I look back. In the cottage where my family spent a number of summers, former tenants had left a shelf of children's books. There I discovered Dorothy and the Land of Oz, and much of Mark Twain that was over my head. One book I read over and over, a thin green volume that was, I think, part of a set called the Deerfoot series. I have never seen this book since, and I do not recall the adventures it contained. But the life of the Indians in the forest cast over me a spell that still echoes like a remembered strain of music. In high school, I was persuaded to join a newly formed band of campfire girls. There, under an imaginative and creative leader, I found a world rich in beauty and symbolism. We wove beaded headbands, adopted Indian names, and wore long brown gowns trimmed with leather fringe and decorated with our own symbols. We held solemn ceremonies, sitting around an imitation campfire laid on the bare floor of a Sunday school room. We were naive as no teenager could possibly be today. Our knowledge of Indian life was of the legendary fabric of Longfellow's Hiawatha. It was pure romance, and I was enthralled by it. Even now, after 60 years of moving about, in which almost all my childhood treasures have disappeared, I have never been able to discard that fringed brown dress. When, many years later, I began to recreate that story from New England history, I needed not fantasy but facts about the Indians, and my concern now was for authenticity, not romance. The history of the American Indian is not romantic. It is deeply tragic and continues to be so today, and the records are heartbreaking. When I was working on Calico Captive, I could not envision the Abnakis as wholly villainous and cruel. I doubt if Susanna herself really found them to be so. The Johnson family was never cruelly treated, the intent of the Indians being only to sell them as hostages to the French in Montreal. And Sylvanus, her 6-year-old son, was adopted into the tribe and lived with the Indians for many years, and though finally he returned to his family, was restless and never truly at home in the white world. Challenging me again, readers ask, why do you choose to write about olden times? I have to admit that history was never my favorite subject in school. I don't even remember liking it very much. I can only answer that from the time I began to relive the adventures of Miriam Willard, I have found the weaving of fact and fiction completely fascinating and engrossing. Every book begins with questions. What must it have been like for these people? What choices would I have made in their place? I must find the answers by going back into the past, by living side by side with them, until the world they lived in becomes as real to me as the room in which I am working. This is an enormously satisfying experience. I find that I always come back to my own problems with renewed perspective and a sort of reinforcement of the spirit. It is exactly these gifts from the past that I think a young person, a person of any age, but especially a young person, can gain from the reading of historical fiction. When I read Bruno Bettelheim's persuasive book, The Uses of Enchantment, I was delighted to find my own tenuous philosophy articulated with a skill which I could never approach. It is his thesis, and I do not quote him exactly, that children need heroes with whom they can identify. heroes who face terrifying and seemingly insurmountable odds, and armed with courage and truth, win out against them. That in reading of such heroes, children are strengthened and given courage to face the very real dangers and difficulties of their own lives. Bettelheim was writing of fairy tales and fantasy, but I thought as I read his words that very much the same function is fulfilled by the historical novel. Historical fiction, too, gives young people heroes who have faced the testing of courage and endurance, and it offers the heartening assurance that in every age there have been men and women who have stood bravely against danger and injustice and tyranny. But history, unlike fairy tales, cannot promise a happy ever-after ending. History itself is a record of injustice, and children learn very early that life is not fair and that dangers have not always been overcome. Even to walk through the living room when the evening news is coming from the television can be a shattering experience for a child. I do not believe that a historical novel should gloss over the pain and ugliness, but I do believe that the hero with whom a young reader identifies should on the last page not be left in despair, but should still be standing with the strength to go on to whatever the future may hold. For one thing I have learned from these letters is that young people need reassurance. They need to have confirmed their own innate sense of the rightness of things, of the value of loyalty, and especially of the bond of family. In by far the greatest number of letters about the sign of the beaver, readers have chosen as the part they like best the time when the family comes back. Perhaps this is because this happens on the last few pages and maybe all they can remember, but the rightness of that reunion seems to satisfy some deep need and to give them the reassurance they crave. One little girl wrote, "It made me want to hug my mom and dad." In all the most loved of children's books, those which through the years children have taken to their hearts, this reassurance runs like a subliminal message beneath the story itself, only occasionally, sometimes never actually breaking through the action. Yet it is there, the author's certainty that life is good. In Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House books, the joy of living runs like a golden thread beneath the laughter, the unrelenting hard work, the sadness, and the happiness. On the last page of the final volume, it shines forth triumphantly. On the evening of their wedding day, Laura Ingalls and her new husband sit on the doorstep of the house that Almanzo has built for his bride. "It is a wonderful night," Almanzo says. "It is a beautiful world," Laura answers. "In giving me this honor, which is in her name, you have encouraged me to hope that somewhere in the words I have written, young readers may catch a glimpse of that golden thread. For this hope, with all my heart, I say again, thank you."